Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the death of Fidel Castro at the age of 90 and speak with Arturo López Levy, a former political analyst with the Cuban government who is now a lecturer at the University of Texas on Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy. The author of Raul Castro and the New Cuba, A Close-Up View of Change, we will discuss the speculation that Fidel Castro's younger brother Raul, who took over the family rule of Cuba in 2006, has been restrained from introducing the necessary reforms to revive Cuba's ailing economy because it involves dismantling the sclerotic system of state power that Fidel constructed. We'll also look into what might happen to the historic rapprochement between the U.S. and Cuba brokered by the Pope, and whether a President Trump will undo the progress made by Raul Castro and Barack Obama. Then we'll assess the 50-year-long U.S. embargo and countless assassination attempts on Castro's life, which just ended with him having outlived 10 U.S. presidents. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals, joins us. We'll also discuss the makeup of Trump's new national security team with the addition of a Fox News political hack, K.T. McFarlane, as the deputy national security advisor. Then finally, we'll examine the role of fake news manufactured by Russian intelligence that was inserted into the U.S. media during the election campaign to undermine Hillary Clinton and stoke fears among the American left that the two nuclear-armed rivals were heading towards a nuclear confrontation. A former Russian journalist, Soufiane Djemoukov, a visiting scholar at the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at George Washington University, joins us to discuss Putin's announced desire in a pep talk to the employees of RT, Russia Today, to, quote, break the Anglo-Saxon monopoly on the global information streams. And joining us now is Arturo López Levy, who's a lecturer at the University of Texas and an expert on Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy. In Cuba, before his emigration to the United States, he worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government before resigning his position. He is the author of Raul Castro and the New Cuba, A Close-Up View of Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arturo López Levy.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a great pleasure to be with you and the audience.
Thank you so much, Arturo. And am I correct in the speculation that Fidel Castro's younger brother, Raul, was somewhat restrained from introducing necessary reforms to revive Cuba's economy because it was a challenge, in effect, to the Communist Party structures that his older brother, Fidel, constructed?
Ian, I hate to say it, but I think that you are right on that, but only on the margins. Mm-hmm. I think that, obviously, the legacy of Fidel Castro and his vision about socialism was more doctrinaire, and the period when he was the president, he instituted policies that were more in favor of a command economy and a more vertical relationship between the Cuban state and civil society. But Raul has been in charge of the reform for already 10 years, and he doesn't owe his position now to anybody. He is in itself a powerhouse within the revolutionary family, and he is the one who has played a central role on the timing, sequence, and outreach of the reform.
So is there then, is it correct to say that he's less ideological than his brother? He's more pragmatic?
I think he has to be, because without the Fidel Castro's charisma as a pillar of the system, then you need to go to other zones of legitimacy. And one of these zones is economic performance. Remember that the Cuban Revolution has two central ideologies. It was not only communism, but also nationalism. Today, they are resting more on the nationalist pillar, and they need to build up other forms of support from the population. And one important is trying to achieve a better economic performance that will allow them to keep some of the redistributive policies that the revolution installed after 1959.
But obviously, the U.S. embargo has been an incredibly big factor in affecting the Cuban economy over this 50-year period. And then, of course, to a large extent, Cuba was what made up for what the U.S. was denying Cuba's access to the world. The Russians made up for it, or the Soviets did. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, suddenly they pulled away their subsidies, and Cuba went through a period where they had to really improvise. And then, in effect, what we're told is that Hugo Chavez in Venezuela came to Cuba's rescue with oil subsidies, which the Soviets cut off, or then now the Russians. But now, Venezuela itself is in a state of economic freefall, and I imagine those oil subsidies may at some point be in jeopardy. So, is that a fair summary of Cuba's vulnerability?
I think this is a fair summary. I will add that Cuba, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, survived on its own for more than almost a decade. The role of Venezuela as part of this partnership with the Cuban Revolution began by 2003-2004, is the moment when Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez signed the ALBA Treaty, the so-called Bolivarian Alternative for Americas. But Cuba find a way to survive and even grow economically after the collapse of the Soviet Union by opening, and this is something that you need to take to account also on the legacy of Fidel, that he was pragmatic enough to begin some of the economic reforms that later will multiply or expanded by Raúl. Cuba began its opening to foreign investment by 1995. By 1995, also it began an opening to a small opening to small companies, private companies, and some reforms in agriculture. But you are right in general. It came to the rescue and helped a lot the alliance with Chavez, and today a big question mark about Cuba's economic future is what's going to happen with the relationship with Venezuela. But I want to ratify this issue that Cuba survived on its own, because now when we have a discussion about U.S. policy towards Cuba, and some people close to the Trump administration are the coming Trump administration are beginning to say that there should be a rollback to the policy of hostility, it is evident that the December 17, 2014 agreement between Cuba and the United States was the result of the failure of this hostility policy that President Obama recognized that it was attempted by 11 American presidents without any success.
And again, I'm speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who is a lecturer at the University of Texas and expert on Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy. In Cuba, before his emigration to the United States, he worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government until he resigned his position. And he's the author of Raúl Castro and the New Cuba, A Close-Up View of Change. So how much could Trump roll back the progress made in this historic recent agreement between Raul Castro and President Obama, which I understand was brokered by the Pope.
Yes, you are right. I think that if we think from a foreign policy rational perspective, President Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, should respect the move that President Obama made. In reality, this move is well argued in the most recent presidential executive order of October 2016, and all the arguments provided by defense agencies, economic departments such as the Department of Commerce, the law enforcement agencies such as the Homeland Security Department, all of them agree that a policy of dialogue and communication with Cuba is in the best interest and values of the United States. However, do I believe that President Trump will take into account all this argument? Well, we know that many things in American politics happen not based on national interest or national values rationality, and already some members of the administration has warned the public and Cuba and the Obama administration that they plan to change course and kowtow again to the most visceral and resentful agenda of a group that is not even anymore the majority of the Cuban American community. But, you know, it's a reality of politics. Sometimes people don't learn from the experience of 20, 30, 40, 50, and almost even 60 years of a failed policy towards Cuba. And it will be tragic, but it looks that the United States might lose in its relationship with Cuba another, at least a presidential term, if President-elect Trump fulfill or honor the promises that he made. I still believe that there will not be ever a rollback to the zero square, because obviously Cuba has been taken off the list of terrorist nations of the State Department, and there is no reason for General Flynn, the new National Security Advisor, or anybody to claim that Cuba is now suddenly a terrorism-sponsored nation, and it is justified to add Cuba back to the list.
Well, unfortunately, in terms of the Cuban-American right-wing influence, and of course you've got three U.S. senators, two of whom, Senator Cruz and Marco Rubio, ran for president as Republicans. You know, you have this surreal situation, for example, with radio and television Martí. The U.S. taxpayer spends over $100 million a year on a program that broadcasts U.S. anti-Castro propaganda to Cuba, and it's routinely jammed by the Cuban authorities, but that doesn't stop them from maintaining this surreal fiction where you have extremely expensive production. Every day they broadcast these people. They're all on the government payroll. Nobody listens to this, but they keep it going because of this animus that simply cannot stop.
This is a great example, what you just mentioned, Ian. This is a typical case of government waste, and this is the outcome of Cuban-American right-wing lobbyists. President-elect Trump claimed that he's going to drain the swamp in Washington, that he's not going to surrender American national interest to lobbyists. In practice, he already had a guy by the name of Mauricio Claver Caroni, that is the lobbyist per excellence, who has been advocating for this crazy policy and fundings for his friends in Miami in the so-called regime change programs against Cuba. And frankly, even the government accountability offices in several reports have said that there is a huge waste of money happening there. They have been buying even very heavy coats supposedly to send to the Cuban dissidents. And everybody knows that in Cuba, the weather is it's so much so good that even in December, you can go to the beach. And there are a lot of Americans that now, given the policies of President Obama, they are taking advantage of that. Everybody knows that those heavy coats are not needed in Cuba, but they were bought on the idea that they will serve to promote democracy in Cuba. And nobody knows what was done with the money that was spent on that. And you mentioned the case of Radio and TV Martí that basically is not watched or listened to in the island.
Well, that is the, you know, it's almost like a zombie policy that we have. And it's a terrifying thought that Trump would go back to the zombie policy. So just in the last couple of minutes then, what is your sense of there? Obviously, we mentioned the fact that Venezuela's economy is in free fall. There's also reports that a lot of Cubans are trying to leave the island to get the preferential treatment here on the in the United States, which people expect that that may change. So there's a contradiction there between the possibility of Trump rolling back the clock and the idea that that I think it's called the wet foot, dry foot policy, whatever it is called. Cuban refugees do get preferential treatment as opposed to the Haitians. So in general, is there anything that can happen from Raul Castro that could signal something that might stop the Trump people from doing something stupid?
I don't think that the Raul Castro government will do anything just to appease the Trump administration. I hope that that President-elect Trump use, let's say, a business rationality to judge the policy that has been presented by some of his followers in Miami. But if he insists on going on the hostility route, let me tell you something. The Cuban nationalism is kind of Godzilla. The more hostility you show to it and transmit to it, the more the Cuban people rally around the Cuban flag, and it will strengthen more the hardliners in the Cuban government. And I think that it has been proven with almost six decades that the will to be independent of the Cuban people will resist, and they will do it with President Trump if he tried to go this way.
Well, Arturo López-Levy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who's a lecturer at the University of Texas and expert on Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy in Cuba. Before his emigration to the United States, he worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government until resigning his position. He's the author of Raul Castro and the New Cuba, A Close-Up View of Change. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the countless assassination attempts on Castro's life and also the Fox News political hack, who is now the Deputy National Security Advisor. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And The Guardian is carrying a story saying that there were 638 attempts to kill Fidel Castro. Poison pills, toxic cigars, exploding mollusks, etc. It is an interesting thing to speculate on. Because I've certainly followed what happened with Desmond Fitzgerald, the CIA station chief in Paris, who Cuban Arturo, I think he was a colonel or a captain, Colonel Cabela, who came into the embassy as what they call a walk-in, the U.S. embassy, and said he wanted to kill Castro. He had the access to do so. He was given all kinds of exploding cigars and poisoned scuba outfits and all this kind of stuff, all of which is in a museum in Havana today. And the one thing that Cabela kept asking Fitzgerald was, who are these orders coming from? And eventually Fitzgerald told him they're coming from the president, Kennedy. And then it turned out, of course, that Cabela was what they call a dangle. He went back to Cuba and gave Castro all the information about how the U.S. president was determined to kill him. Now, this is a long-winded way to say that if there's any credibility to this cottage industry of assassinations, particularly on JFK, the only one that seems vaguely credible to me, and this, I believe, is what Kennedy's vice president and successor, President Lyndon Johnson, who you work for, always believed, was that Fidel Castro killed Kennedy because Kennedy was trying to kill him.
Well, the exploding mollusk I've always thought of as a symbol of American policy toward Cuba, both in the last days of the Eisenhower administration and then under John Kennedy. No question that this is one of the darker chapters of American foreign policy. There were numerous efforts to kill Castro especially after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, but there were efforts even before then. That's what involved the CIA even more intimately than they had been with the mafia, with organized crime, because of course organized crime had been quite intimately connected in the old Batista Cuba that Castro overthrew, owning casinos and so on. All of this is immortalized in the Godfather films, but this is a dark stain on the record both of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, two liberal icons, I suppose, for generations of Americans, and there was a certain coterie of officials in the U.S. government who were entirely in support of this, certainly at the CIA and elsewhere. They were rather gullible about some of these things that happened, as the Desmond Fitzgerald story shows. They were totally unequipped to cope with Castro's popularity. Your other guest said when the Cubans are under attack from outside, they rally to the flag. That's exactly what happened with all of these attempts, and what was seen quite rightly as relentless American hostility, violent American hostility, even though after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States pledged solemnly to the Soviet Union and to Cuba that they would not try to effect the violent overthrow of the Castro regime. Those efforts continued. Again, another stain on the integrity and on the intelligence, general sense and sensibility of American foreign policy, because this was almost always an impotent and fruitless effort.
Well, in terms of the Cuba crisis, though, I've spoken at length to Sergei Khrushchev, the son of the former Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, who obviously JFK was trying to deal with at that moment when the fate of the world hung in the balance.
Yes.
What happened then, this is what Sergei told me, was that once the Kennedy administration and Khrushchev had made the deal to de-escalate the nuclear standoff that could have led to a nuclear war over the existence of Russian nuclear weapons, and particularly tactical nuclear weapons in Cuba. What happened there was that Castro was so mad, he felt that the Russians had sold him out, that he actually sent some of his special forces in to capture some of these Russian weapons, and there was quite a shootout. So
yes.
I'm always astounded that any liberal in the West thinks this Fidel Castro is such a great guy. He almost tried to have us, the world blow up. I mean,
well, and that's very interesting to tell that story, because there was always this tension between Castro and the Kremlin, and there was this sense of betrayal, treachery, really, on the part of the Russians. Don't forget that Castro was quite instrumental in giving the green light to the installation of Soviet missiles. Thought this was a further guarantee of his maintenance of power. It was because of those reactions, which were known to American intelligence, at least in some outline form, that Lyndon Johnson always believed that Castro had developed an absolutely cold and obdurate hatred for the Kennedy administration, that there was no bargaining with that and no relief of it, and that Castro had in fact been complicit in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And as you know, the historical record shows that Johnson believed that rather devoutly. He was not contradicted by members of the intelligence community who, if not sharing that view completely, at least thought it plausible. It turns out to be, as you said, Ian, much the more, I think, realistic interpretation of this whole notion of conspiracy in the JFK assassination. Of course, it did involve Oswald and all of that trail that we know so well in Mexico City and the rest.
So, but in terms of actually trying to provoke World War III, and again, it did happen. Why do liberals in and leftists in both Europe and the United States see Castro as such a hero without recognizing that, you know, we dodged a bullet, but for him,
well,
we'd all be dead.
It's
symptomatic,
you know, of this plague, and I use the word quite literally, this plague of ignorance and naivete, which still infects liberal elements in the United States about American foreign policy. There was a generation of young Americans who grew up with the horrors of the Batista regime. They were parallel to other dictators around the world. And remember that at that point, at the end of the 1950s, the CIA had overthrown an elected government in Guatemala, where they had overthrown an elected government in Tehran, in Iran. The horrors of American intervention and of support of dictatorial right-wing regimes were sort of the staple of American college and postgraduate educations in world affairs in the latter 1950s. Castro was seen as a great liberator. I remember quite vividly watching on television as he rode atop a tank into Havana. It was seen as a redress of grievances that went back, of course, to the beginning of the 20th century, the Spanish-American War, and to the long exploitation and repression of Cuba under American auspices. So I think that original notion of Castro as the liberator was very, very hard to dispel. And despite all of the vivid evidence in the bodies that came to Miami not just fleeing as members of the old Batista regime, but people who were social democrats and liberals and ordinary citizens who had been savagely repressed by the Castro regime. Despite all of that evidence, I think that much of the American left sort of clung to that original misconception of Castro. Very hard, of course, then to overcome the further idolatrization of Che Guevara, who became, you know, when you become a T-shirt in Haight-Ashbury, and when you become an icon of the American left, rational thought often is the casualty.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. But on the other side, of course, you can really criticizing liberals, you can criticize the Kennedy administration. Kennedy administration's response to Castro was absolutely catastrophic. The Alliance for Progress, which they thought, well, we got to organize all these Latin American regimes and Central American regimes to oppose Castro. So what did they do? They sent tons of money, guns, military training, police training to all of these repressive regimes in places like El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala, and Brazil, and all throughout Latin America to stop Castro, and they bred the worst kind of fascist regimes.
You know, it's the fear of Castro and of his influence as much as the fear directly of any Soviet encroachment in the Western Hemisphere, which was used as always as the larger excuse, the public excuse. But it was that fear of Castro and the infection of anti-Americanism in the hemisphere that drove all of that. Ian, you're quite right. It drove American interventions, covert and overt. It somewhat explains the coup in Chile. It explains American complicity in torture. My goodness, we had something called the Office of Public Safety, which was a CIA front program run under the Agency for International Development, which was supposed to be instructing foreign police forces in traffic control and public safety, and in fact was doing a lot of more covert and awful, rather hideous work in torture and interrogation techniques and all the rest. This went on constantly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, on through the Johnson administration, into Nixon, of course, and on to Ford and on through the rest of the century. The reaction to Castro was one of the more insidious influences in American foreign policy in Latin America, and I can argue that it explains most of what the United States did and did not do, and our irrational hatred of that regime, our fear of that regime, kept us from seeing even its more positive elements and its positive influence, not only in Cuba but in the rest of the world. And involved us at one point in direct covert operations against the Cubans in Southern Africa, as you'll remember. I mean, this was an international disaster that stemmed from the Kennedys' original hostility to Fidel Castro. So the man who just died is quite an epic figure, of course, in the history of Latin America and the history of U.S. relations in Latin America, but an epic figure in American foreign policy, and may well have been involved in the assassination of an American president. So it's quite a historic moment.
And, of course, we intervened in South Africa, Angola, to prop up one of the most disgusting racist regimes in history, the South African government. So let's talk a little bit about then, in the next few minutes here, Roger Morris, about what's happening now with the National Security Council. Of course, we have a complete, I hesitate to say a nut job, but I think General Flynn is somebody that's very, very dangerous. I mean, Trump himself is an unstable personality. who a psychiatrist could have a field day with. And it's a scary prospect of him being president of the United States. But the idea that the national security advisor, who at the end of the day is supposed to be the person that protects the president from himself, the idea that this guy was kicked out by JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, because JSOC thought he was too unstable. My God. And then on top of that, you've got his deputy, where you'd think if you've got a pretty unstable national security advisor, at least put a professional in there as the deputy to deal with reality, because that job is all about reality, not ideology. Well, who do they put in there? A Fox News political hack, a complete ideologue.
Well, you were not, of course, the first one, Ian, I have to say, who called General Flynn a nut job. That was Colin Powell in a leaked email. He had been talking to Flynn's successor at the Defense Intelligence Agency, who had said, well, he was fired because he was abusive of staff and had chaotic management techniques and didn't follow national policy and et cetera, violated almost every rule of the honor and integrity of the American military, as well as just ordinary political protocol of someone serving in a senior position. He was elevated to lieutenant general and appointed to the DIA, of course, by Barack Obama, and that even after he had been part of the McChrystal cabal in Kabul, that of course had led to Stanley McChrystal's sacking by the president after the great Rolling Stone article on this runaway general. I think this is a genuine tragedy. If we can look at it with a little more distance, this is a 33-year veteran of the American Army. Started out as an ROTC lieutenant way back at the beginning of the 1980s, rose to lieutenant general, combat experience in Grenada and in Haiti, speaking of Latin America, as well as in Afghanistan and Iraq, gets his baptism in intelligence and his education very much inside the military. I mean, I think he's got a BA from a state college in Rhode Island, but other than that, a product of the Command and General Staff School, and I think the Naval War College and others, other credentials that I've seen, all of it in service training, and then he's thrown into to the interrogation of Al-Qaeda prisoners in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and forms from that this conviction that the United States is not understanding the nature of Islamic terrorism and not understanding the overall existential threat to the country at large. You could argue that this is a man who really was pushed and embittered somewhat in Castro-like terms, we were just talking about, by being fired. He was fired a full year before his tenure was to come to an end at DIA, and by all of the differences that he had with the Obama administration. And like any White House, these fights go on, as you well know. I certainly was in the middle of some of them. These fights go on under every administration. There's a certain amount of resistance from the Pentagon and from people in the field, as there is from the CIA and the State Department and American ambassadors abroad and so on. Flynn really simply crosses the line in temperament and in personality and certainly in political judgment in much of what he did. He's going to be supervising an NSC of unprecedented power. I was one of 12 senior officers on a staff of about 48 or 50 in the Nixon administration. It's now a staff of over 400. It is quite literally an alternative foreign ministry in the United States, and it has enormous power. Flynn will be sitting there as chair of most of the operational committees. He'll be deciding everything from the targets of drone strikes to American diplomatic strategy toward Russia, toward China, toward NATO, all of the realms of American foreign policy. So we've got an embittered former general who left the reservation even while he was in the ranks and who violated military protocol has come under criticism by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs who recognized this. This is a great American tradition which he violates. But then again, he's working for a president who has violated almost every political tradition in the country. So as for McFarlane, his otherwise known as Kathleen, when I first knew her and knew of her, she was, a 19 or 20-year-old student at George Washington University who was volunteering as an intern as a typist in the West Wing of Henry Kissinger's NSC operation in the White House. And we had a reference to people like her in what she did in subsequent years. We called it shinnying, as you shinny up a pole or shinny up a tree. She did that with rather constant political calculus and emerges eventually, I think, as an aide to Kissinger on the later NSC staff, not more than a typist when I knew her, but then goes on to work on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and as a spokesman and aide to Caspar Weinberger in the Reagan administration, leaves and goes off and gets some graduate work, graduate degrees, and really becomes one of the few female fixtures in Republican politics on the national security side, and gets the Fox job, and there she becomes, of course, a fairly well-known personality. But this is someone who is distinctly short on substance and has a decided belligerent, rather I would call it Cold War II view of the world. She was on the board of the old Jamestown Foundation, which you may remember was founded by a Russian defector, Shevchenko, from the United Nations back in the 80s, and takes a very belligerent view of Eurasia and Russia and China. That's its specialty. Jim Woolsey was a fellow board member with her. She was close to Dick Cheney and to some of the neocons, not directly associated with the neocons in the George W. Bush years, but always a figure in more cold, hardline Republican politics and foreign policy.
Well, so just in closing, Roger,
much of a balance here.
Right.
If she's the best we can hope for on the foreign policy side in the White House, it's rather a frail hope.
Right, and she's famous for offering General Petraeus, asking General Petraeus to run for president while he was working as a general in Afghanistan under President Obama, to go against Obama in 2012. And she promised Petraeus that the campaign would be run by Roger Ailes and financed by Rupert Murdoch. Of course, General Petraeus didn't take up the offer, and presumably he was the source of the audio recording of the offer. I thank you for joining us, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the role of fake news manufactured by Russian intelligence that was inserted into the U.S. media during the election campaign.
Change. Things have gotta change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sufyan Shamukov, who is a visiting scholar at the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at George Washington University. He was editor-in-chief of the newspapers Karbino, Balkarska, Pravda, and the voice of Kabada, and a former Kennan Fulbright scholar, and recently received fellowships from the U.S. Institute for International Education and the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. And since 2013, Dr. Shamukov has been working as a senior research associate in the program on new approaches to research and security in Asia at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sufyan Shamukov.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you, Sufyan. And there was a recent study came out by the Foreign Policy Research Institute headlined Trolling for Trump, How Russia is Trying to Destroy Our Democracy. And you at the center there as well, at Panaras at GWU, also been working in similar territory. But let's start with the quoting Vladimir Putin himself when he went to RT, Russia Today, their headquarters, the broadcast center in Moscow, in 2013 to give the employees a pep talk. He announced to the employees, quote, that he wanted to break the Anglo-Saxon monopoly on the global information streams. And if it's all true, what we've been hearing about Russian interference in this election, he's certainly, I don't know whether he's broken the international streams, but it looks as if he might have even had a hand in electing the president of the United States.
Well, you're right. One of the missions of the Kremlin is to create a very strong international media agency, and they did it with Russia Today, that they want to be competing with CNN, BBC, and other world-leading agencies. But that's one side of it. Another side of it is the Kremlin's understanding of what they call soft power. So around 2008, Putin, at a meeting of foreign service officials in Russia, he announced that there is this thing that the West calls soft power, so we need to advance in that. But the problem there is that soft power, in his understanding, in the Kremlin's understanding, is not the cultural influence as the West understands, but it is non-military influence. So it's kind of Cold War way of thinking. So since 2008, in that way, Russia advanced very much. And now the suspicion that Russia may influence the U.S. presidential elections actually shows the evolution of so-called Kremlin way soft power advance.
Well, that, is, of course, is a revival, is it not, since Vladimir Putin is a former KGB officer, is a revival of what the KGB used to call active measures, the gray area of propaganda, the white being analysis and the black being operations. If you look at RT, one of the things where they've been extremely successful is in their YouTube channel, the English language YouTube channel, which they launched in 2017. It has 1.85 million subscribers, but it has a total of 1.8 billion views, which makes it the most widely viewed, more so than CNN's YouTube channel. So that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, if what we're being told is that a lot of the fake news about Hillary Clinton having very poor health, and that there's a likelihood of a nuclear war between Russia and the U.S., which the Kremlin was inserting in our media to presumably make U.S. liberals nervous and therefore not want to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yes, all fake news, and it's proven now, Not all. I mean, many fake news are proven to be originated in Russia. And when we're talking about Russia, and the president-elect actually kind of dismissed it, saying that it doesn't have to be a Russian secret service, but can be, as he said, the 400-pound guy sitting on his sofa. But when we are talking about Russia and something that sophisticated originated in Russia, we can certainly say that the Russian Secret Service is behind it, because unlike the U.S., where private citizens and hackers maybe even can do something on their own, in Russia, the whole cyber space is controlled by a secret service, and all providers, all internet providers in Russia, and all mobile phone, cell phone providers, they have to give access, not just give access, but have to record everything and give the secret service access to it. So that there can be no private hacking of such sophistication in Russia, which is unknown to the Secret Service or wasn't initiated by the Secret Service.
So in other words, Russian citizens have to open up their social media and their internet traffic to the Secret Service so that they know exactly what everybody's doing. At the same time, they are able to organize these hackers as a sort of army. They also apparently have what they call troll farms, which is these, you know, organizing hundreds and hundreds of these trolls to you know, insert this fake news, right?
Yes, there are troll factories or troll farms, as you said. And there were several journalist investigations inside Russia before, like, the government stopped it. And one of them was by Novaya Gazeta, one of few free medias in Russia. So several of their journalists, somehow they applied for jobs working at these troll factories in St. Petersburg and Moscow, and they worked there until they were fired, and then they were pretty fired pretty fast. They didn't advance in their career there, actually, but still they were able to disclose those troll factories from inside. And another example of how the Secret Service controls and takes over every sophisticated, every creative initiative in this sphere was this two young IT professionals created a program that allowed you to point your phone on the street to somebody, and then instantly you would get information about that person on your phone. If that person would have an account in this social media called VKontakte. VKontakte is very popular in Russia. It is kind of Russian Facebook.
Right.
So instantly, as soon as they developed that program, FSB bought it. They instantly sold it to FSB. So the Russian Secret Service just takes over every such an initiative.
Right, but the guy that started VKontakte, the Russia's equivalent of Facebook, he resisted the Secret Service, and he finally had to leave the country in exile. I don't know whether they basically the Kremlin took over VKontakte and got rid of him. I don't know whether he was able to take any money with him, but he was certainly sent into exile. So
exactly, Mr. Durov, who created VKontakte, he refused. Mm-hmm. To give it officially to a Secret Service, so they took it by force. And now he immigrated to Great Britain and started a new company, new social media called Telegraph.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Sufyan Shamukov, who is a visiting scholar at the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at George Washington University, a former Russian journalist. He is a senior research associate at the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia at the George Washington University. So just in the last few minutes, Sufyan, it's an extraordinary situation to have this, the level of interference in our elections that Russia, all the intelligence services have agreed that Russia's been involved. We don't know the full extent to it. The problem is that they clearly wanted to help elect Trump. I'm not sure that these theories that Trump is Putin's Manchurian candidate, I think that's kind of ridiculous because you can't control Trump. He's completely uncontrollable. But on the other hand, Trump is going to be a disaster for the United States, and he's going to weaken America around the world. And that probably is what Putin's motive is. What do you think Putin has been up to?
Well, if we kind of distance themselves, as you said, from conspiracy theories, we can say that Trump is a better candidate for Putin than Hillary Clinton. Not just because, like, he's crazy or something like that, but because every new president launched kind of a reset with Putin. Bush looked into his soul. Obama launched a reset. And when Obama did that, it was with Hillary Clinton, and it was Hillary Clinton's program. So this time, if Hillary would come to power, she wouldn't launch a new reset, but she would continue on Obama's legacy of this very negative relations between the U.S. and Russia. Meanwhile, Trump, following that tradition, and he announced it several times, he's willing to start from a clean slate, and it's very beneficial for Putin because Putin will be doing this do-over for the third time. So he's very experienced in that. While Trump will be doing for the first time, no matter how smart or crazy he is. So for Putin, it is very beneficial, just in political terms, that Trump came to power.
Well, indeed. And, of course, Trump has been had a number of phone conversations already with Vladimir Putin. I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Sufyan Shamukov, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Sufyan Shamukov, who is a visiting scholar at the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at George Washington University. He's the was editor-in-chief of the newspapers Karino Bakarasika Pravda and Voice of Kabarda, and a former Kennan Fulbright scholar. And he, since 2013, Dr. Shamukov has been working as a senior research associate at the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia at George Washington University. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and producer Jose Benavides. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And this, of course, has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.